What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Reporter Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how's it going?
Going okay. And also Podcast Producer Ben Ellman. Hey, Ben.
We've got so much news.
So much news, including a quick update on pretty much everything we talked about last episode. A lot is happening, both in the tech world and in the political world that affects all this, too. So this week, we'll be diving into some of the updates from the TikTok ban that was not. Some thoughts on that. I have thoughts on the NVIDIA RTX 5090, which I spent a couple days, most of this week, reviewing, but I wish I had gotten it earlier. Sam has a lot of thoughts on the Samsung Galaxy S25 launch event, that Unpacked event. And we will all be breaking down kind of the new political order with the new Trump administration. A lot of things have happened, a lot of executive orders, and clearly a sign of like what they plan to do when it comes to the environment, when it comes to the tech industry, all sorts of stuff. Stay tuned to the end of this episode. I'll also be chatting with YouTube project manager Jack Greenberg. He's in charge of YouTube Premium, which is launching some new features this week. We get into a good conversation about that and how useful that service is too. It's one of those things I like, and I think kind of an undersung great streaming service. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review in iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast. And Engadget.com. And have to say, I guess not RIP TikTok. So here was the thing. Last week we talked about, with Carissa Bell from Engadget, we talked about the potential TikTok ban coming, and a lot of stuff happened after we recorded. So the Supreme Court unanimously said that they're not going to stop the potential ban. And then TikTok had a bit of a countdown. On Friday and Saturday, I saw a lot of posts from people that were basically, here's my last post, RIP, thanks for all the memories and something.
And even more than that, yeah. It was tearful. It was so many people saying, like, I felt like I built a community.
Yeah.
There were some people who really relied on TikTok for, like, a significant amount of supplemental income. I saw at least one person who said they had a full-time job, but they still count TikTok as their income from TikTok as, like, a significant amount of their income that like really helps them live. This person was not an influencer. They were just like a person who posted a bunch and eventually got like a couple hundred thousand followers.
That's something. I mean, that's every time, even if it's like a potentially dangerous service, I don't know, and we'll talk about like all that stuff, but it's a community. Like you're losing your friends, even if you're losing your followers, you're losing like the thing you used to do every day. For me, TikTok was the place where I would love to just like sit and unwind after like the onslaught of bad news and everything. My daughter and I would love like scrolling it and finding fun videos and stuff. Like just the way you discover things, a lot of fun. I don't know if TikTok meant anything to you, Sam.
No, I mean, I definitely feel for the people who like, When you build up a community and then the whole platform just gets taken offline and you're like, there's a void in your life. I think that's something that I think everyone can sort of identify in different, avenues of their life. But
it's one of those things. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as like, I'm not a big TikTok user or social media user in general. So It didn't have as much impact on me. Although, ByteDance, which is, TikTok's parent company, they also own some game published and stuff like that. So I couldn't
play. Yeah, that's right. Marvel Snap. Yeah,
I couldn't play Marvel
Trickle
Snap
down
over
effects,
the weekend.
Baby.
And that was just like really weird. You like open up the game and says, oh, we're gone. We're trying to come back soon. And then, hey, we don't know what's going to happen. And then eventually they did come back and the game's back online now. But it's just like, that's just like a really weird side effect that like, I don't think people were, they were so focused on TikTok that they didn't think about all the other companies or apps that, ByteDance is kind of in charge of.
And we should talk about like the broader political context here too. But go ahead, Ben. Yep.
Yeah, I can cover both of those things. So what shut down on Saturday night? It was TikTok. It was Marvel Snap. It was CapCut. It was eventually Lemon8, which was, I think,
I had not like even
kind
heard
of
that,
a tick,
but yeah.
Yeah, a TikTok like kind of competitor to Instagram or something. It was like a cross between microblogging, Blue Sky X style stuff and Instagram.
I noticed I was getting invites to Lemon8 within TikTok and I was still like, what the hell is this? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So after the Supreme Court upheld the ban on Friday, TikTok did its big countdown of saying, hey, we're going to be going offline as of Sunday. So everyone was doing their really like tearful posts saying, I'm going to miss everyone so much. I saw one user mention that it felt like the end of eighth grade because yeah, everyone yes, knew yes. that they were going to different schools, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And nobody knew whether or not they were going to see their internet friends again.
Every time a social network dies, it's that same thing. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah.
I was hanging out. I was like scrolling to my heart's content on Saturday night. And I figured that we had until like 12:01 Sunday morning, technically. That didn't happen. The TikTok actually shut down around 10:30 or so. It threw up a error message. Once you tried to sign into the app again, like if you closed the app, it said at first, we regret a U.S. law banning TikTok will take effect on January 19 and force us to make our services temporarily unavailable. We're working to restore service in the U.S. as soon as possible, and we appreciate your support. Please stay tuned. And then within a couple of hours, it changed to... a law banning TikTok has been enacted by the U.S. Unfortunately, that means that you can't use TikTok for now.
Yeah.
We are fortunate that President Trump has indicated that he will work with the U.S. on a solution to reinstate TikTok once he takes office. Please stay tuned. Because this was happening the day before a new president was inaugurated on Monday the 20th. President-elect at the time, Trump, said that he really wanted to do something about saving TikTok and that this was one of his first priorities. People were talking a lot about how Democrats really bungled into this situation because Trump was the one who started the TikTok ban in the first place. He started it by executive order. Then it was codified into law this past May of 2024 as part of an omnibus bill that ended up funding weapons for Ukraine and Israel as well. So it was kind of like a big national security, like helping our allies sort of thing. So there was a... like 12 hours, 14 hours, I think.
14 hours seems about right, yeah.
Yeah, according to NPR, that TikTok was not available. And then it just came back, and they're like, thank you so much, President Trump. Like, we are looking forward to working with you in the future.
And it's worth pointing out, like, how very clear that messaging was. Because this was a pop-up message we were getting within TikTok, and... it was almost as if ByteDance was very much like politicizing its own base to be like, hey, it's up to the Trump administration to save us. Hey, thank you to the Trump administration. Really painting a picture of like who is saved everybody's favorite social network.
Yeah.
That, so I found that kind of odd. For sure.
That's my biggest just frustration with this whole saga is that Trump originally manufactured the problem and then he gets to come back later and manufacture the solution when it was all a bunch of nonsense to begin with. And it's just like,
yeah,
people cheering about, oh, how Trump saved TikTok. And it's like, no, he didn't.
Yep.
It was also manufactured via xenophobia and xenophobia. You know, this was from the time when he was calling COVID-19, the China virus. And so, of course, this is like the China app or something. So this is coming from just like four sagas ago in, you know, American politics.
And now he likes TikTok because TikTok people helped him get elected. He was able to blow up on TikTok.
Allegedly. I think
they invested a lot of money in promoting his shit on TikTok too. So
I heard one person mention a figure. Please don't quote me on this, but the figure mentioned was that Turning Point USA, the conservative like political action group for young people, was getting something like 60 million views a month on TikTok. And the Republican Party, Trump especially, was like, hey, this is really useful to us.
Yeah. And I'm sure we have not seen the numbers yet, but I'm looking at all the money Elon Musk was throwing around to help Trump get elected. I'm sure some of that went to TPUSA too. We'll probably hear about that.
Oh, eventually. Yeah.
We should talk about like where we are right now because we've got a lot of stuff to cover too. So Trump has delayed the TikTok ban for 75 days via an executive order. That's where we are now. There are discussions that he could not have actually promised that TikTok was going to be okay and the people, you know, serving TikTok in the U.S. there's actually no way to, for him to like assure those companies that they were okay to re-enable TikTok and start serving the site again, because he wasn't president. He was just a guy who was going to be president with no actual powers. But hey, nothing matters anymore, right? So he can say whatever he wants and sort of paint himself as the hero once again. Just a wild state of affairs.
Also, the 70, is it 70 or 75 days?
I see 75 days, at least on our story.
Okay, yeah, so the 75-day limit also is, like, has no basis in the actual federal law. Because the federal law says that if TikTok makes some significant motion toward divestment and, like, selling to a U.S. company or something, then you can grant a 90-day extension where TikTok is no longer banned. So that would be 3 months. So this is like somewhere in the middle. It doesn't agree with the text of the federal law. Trump is talking about some kind of joint partnership. And let's also remember, like, TikTok, yes, does have some kind of connection to like China, Southeast Asia, and you know, all of their like big-headed bureaucrats and strongmen. So who knows if Trump himself is getting rolled by someone who is just a little bit smarter in dealing with leaders with a lot of they think highly of themselves, but they're not too smart.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. I also think it's worth pointing out that the TikTok that came back, This is sort of like a Pet Sematary situation, if you're all familiar.
We're talking about Pet Sematary, yes.
It's not exactly the same one that we had before.
It's a little different. It feels like certain other content is... I think people are showing like searches around fascism, searches that were not particularly Trump-friendly, were not working really well.
Yeah, the algorithm's just a little bit different.
It's a little bit different. A lot of people have been saying that at this point, it almost seems clear that every major social network has basically been co-opted by the right wing, or is at least leaning that way because they wanted to be goody-goody with the Trump administration coming in. So that includes Facebook. That certainly includes Twitter/X. The only one that is sort of like, it's not huge, but it's the one that has sort of prevented this is our lovely Blue Sky. Because it's federated and it's avoiding like it's avoiding these particular, you know, issues. And it also has like a pretty progressive user base. So that's just an interesting situation of where we are. I'm still like occasionally I'm using TikTok now. I'm uploading to TikTok. But I'm like now my feelers are certainly more up in terms of how they're manipulating information, especially after all their, you know, begging and praise for the Trump administration ahead of this too. It's all kind of gross. Social media in general. We're just like getting down a dark path. So anything else you guys want to add about where we are now with TikTok?
This is very much a developing story. Stay tuned to Engadget. Stay tuned to your favorite tech news because the 75-day deadline is going to be coming up sooner than we think. And who knows what's going to happen?
Who knows what's going to happen? This entire weekend has been like a freaking whirlwind because like we were following the TikTok news. I knew Chris and a whole bunch of reporters were like looking, keeping an eye on things on the weekend and writing stories over the weekend. And then the inauguration happened and a whole bunch of more news happened. And I would just love for it to stop just for a second for us to catch our breath. Yeah.
Let's talk about a gadget, though, Dev. Let's talk about the 5090.
Let's talk about the 5090, and this is NVIDIA's GeForce RTX 5090. This is their flagship GPU. It is $2,000. I spent a big chunk of time reviewing and benchmarking this thing, and I have a couple takeaways. You can check out my review on the site right now. I gave an 88 out of 100, not because I think it is a perfect card. I wish it was not $2,000. I really wish NVIDIA wasn't out here really pushing the limits of like really just like pushing like the price range of like what a GPU can be. The 3090, I believe, was $1,500. The 4090 was $1,600, and they're just like creeping up and up and up. It's justifiable. It's a little bit justifiable in terms of what the hardware that they actually put in here. Like this thing has 32 gigabytes of DDR7V RAM. 32 gigabytes of RAM in a video card. My entire desktop system has 32 gigabytes of RAM right now. So that's kind of where we are. And I just had to take a minute to just sort of like soak that in. It is wild, like what this card is. It has 91 billion transistors. It has 21,760 CUDA cores. At the same time, it is also thinner. Like, it's also skinnier than the 4090 was. The 4090 was a big hunkin' beast. It was a three-slot card that really took up a chunk of space inside my desktop. This thing is a two-slot card. It can actually fit into small form factor systems. So it's actually smaller, more efficient, at the same time also more power hungry than the previous car. Just kind of a wild thing.
Yeah, Sam, I saw power draws of up like 550, 600 watts, depending on the, like, you know, use case.
There's in 3DMark, there are benchmarks that you can interact with, like really ray trace benchmarks. So there's one called Speedway. I did the interactive mode so you can like move the camera around and look at characters and stuff. And once I did that, this card was eating 550 watts of power. The card was 100%. The fan was like really blaring, but not like super loud. It's actually not too bad for as far as like a high-end GPU goes. And what's really interesting is, like, as soon as I quit that demo, as soon as I quit any game or something, it gets back down to a really decent idle temperature of like 35 to 40 Celsius. So under that benchmark, when it was fully underloaded, it was 79 to 80. During most games, it's like 70 Celsius. So these are good temperatures for video cards, for people who don't know. And yeah, the actual results too, like, benchmarks are good. It's a fast card. I don't know what to tell you. Like, it is a $2,000 video card that is significantly faster than the 4090. And also, if you add in the stuff around DLSS4, which is NVIDIA's AI upscaling technology, now it offers multi-frame generation, whereas with DLSS 3.5, the last generation one, it could generate one frame for every frame that was actually being rendered by the card. So it almost like doubled your FPS. This card, because of the way DLSS4 works and the increased reliance on AI and Tensor cores, this card can basically, NVIDIA says, like, deliver 8 times the frame rate. Essentially, you can generate three frames for every frame that's actually being rendered by the card. So that's like a 4x upgrade, they call it too. A lot of frames. Let me tell you how many frames, Sam. The frames include 240 FPS in Cyberpunk 2077 in 4K with all the graphics turned all the way up, with ray tracing overdrive mode on, which is like the really intensive ray tracing too, which is like fully reflective. Just a lot of detail happening there. 240 to 250 FPS just cruising through that game. Just wild. Like, I was a little gobsmacked seeing that number. If I tell you this card can get those frame rates, are you impressed, or are you worried about like the potential fake frames, Sam?
I mean, so the multi-frame generation is sort of its own thing. And, like, you know, there are some issues with that where, you know, you still, you know, has its own set of artifacts and stuff like that. But for me, like, you know, people have been talking about this idea of like 4K gaming for a long time, and we've never really had like a GPU that could deliver, you know, all the bells and whistles, graphic settings turned to max at 4K. Until it seems like with this, you know, with the 5090. So I think for me, that's a really interesting kind of just like, you know, benchmark just like of, you know, where gaming is at today. And it, you know, even on a personal level, like we were talking about this before the show, where it's like, I really want to upgrade. You know, I have an older GPU, I have a, you know, a 2080 Ti. And so
that's a good card.
It's a good card, but like, you know, I'm, you know, it's old enough. I'm due for an upgrade. But at the same time, it's like, I would love to get like the top of the line flagship, you know, RTX 5090 card, but $2,000 is like the entire price of what my, you know, desktop CPU cost originally, including the case and motherboard and all that.
That's your entire system.
Yeah, that's my entire system. So it's like, it's really hard to justify. So, you know, maybe, you know, I was like talking like, hey, when the new cards come out, maybe I'll take a look at the 4090, see what the price drop on that is like. Or, you know, maybe wait until later in the spring when, like, the 5070 Ti comes out or the 5080. And then, you know, we'll kind of have, like, a better idea of, like, you know, what this whole generation 50 series really looks like in terms of, like, you know, price performance and what kind of value you're actually getting from that.
That's a good point. Like, I usually tell people when new hardware comes out, if you don't, like, it's not always wise to jump to the most expensive flagship thing. Look at the last gen, see how the prices drop. NVIDIA is saying that the 5070, the RTX 5070, which is $550, is as fast as the 4090 when it comes to frame rates, but it's including these generated frames. So it's including AI-generated frames that can match the actual FPS value of the 4090. But at the same time, there are a lot of other things DLSS 4 is doing. A lot of that is also going to the older card. So they're doing like more efficient ray tracing generation, more efficient... there's all sorts of stuff. The super resolution feature, which is the thing that like delivers higher quality textures, that is more efficient. That's going to be more effective. That's also going to work down to like the 30 series and the 20 series cards. So even the card you have, Sam, will get some benefit from this stuff. But yeah, the question is like, should you invest in something like the 5070 or 5070 Ti, which I believe is $200 more, or even the 5080, rather than a faster last gen card like the 4090? I cannot, like, just given how involved the 4090 is and how big that card is, I can't imagine that thing is going to drop below $1,000.
Yeah,
you know,
it's really going to depend on the market. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Like, those cards probably didn't make too many of those because it's the flagship. Not many people were buying them. You may find some used, but I don't recommend buying used
GPUs, especially. I feel like are such a crapshoot. Where like, hey, you could be lucky and it works great, but then, you know, if it doesn't, you're just like, you have no warranty, nothing to fall back on. And so, yeah, that gets really dicey.
It's like buying a used hot rod because that's how gamers tend to run their GPUs. And these things are, they're drawing a lot of power. The fans are doing a lot of work. Like, they're really easy ways for you to, like, fry a GPU or mess it up if you're overclocking it too much or you stuff it in a case where there's not enough airflow. There's a lot of ways for a GPU to go wrong. So I would just be really careful about that. For your purposes, though, Sam, like, you're thinking of buying, you're considering like rebuilding your whole rig. So you're going to need a new CPU. You're going to need a new motherboard. You're going to need new faster RAM, actually, too. At the end of the day, I don't think anybody should justify spending $2,000 on a single video card unless you are a creative professional or a streamer or somebody or an influencer who is doing a lot of like high-end video work, because this thing does crunch through video transcoding faster than anything I've seen before. If it's the cost of this will help you make money faster, you know, or make content faster, then yeah, that's justifiable. I don't think like it's a $2,000 video card, like on a moral level. I'm like, no.
Yeah, even for me, it would be more of an ego purchase. I can't justify the gameplay performance that, like, you know, that home that, like, I'm like, you know, I'm not streaming. I'm not doing anything with this. I'm not encoding videos.
So do you have a 4K 240 hertz monitor, Sam?
No, but
you need,
you know,
one of those.
So yeah. And so this is all sort of like the big, you know, maybe possible 2025 desktop upgrade for me. It was like, I want a new monitor and I want to revamp the rig. And it's like, And when you consider the price of a $2,000 GPU, suddenly things are getting a lot more expensive than I originally budgeted for. And so I was like, all right, I gotta come back down to earth.
Yeah, yeah. Also, your children have to eat, you know? So you can't spend all your money on GPU money.
But the other thing
is
like...
It's the classic issue of like not wanting to put a Ferrari engine inside one of those 70s Volkswagen Bugs, mm-hmm. right? Like, you need to make sure that the rest of your system can catch up or make the best use of this enormous graphics card.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other thing, the kind of think about it in terms of like a more, you know, market perspective way, is that part of the reason why NVIDIA can price the 5090 at $2,000 is because they have no competition. AMD does not have an equivalent offering for the 5090. And so you see that jump from $1,600 last generation with the 4090 to $2,000 with the 5090. And it's like, We really need more competition, in at least in the top end GPU market, in order for, you know, prices to be a little bit more, you know, approachable.
I don't know if that's like AMD is right now saying like they're focusing on the mid range. They're focusing on things that are like slightly more accessible. They're still doing some low end stuff, but Intel actually out of nowhere with their XeSS cards have actually been doing a good job. The Arc card that I talked about a while ago. $250. There is some price gouging going on there, but you can still get that card for under $300. It's a pretty good deal. It's really up to AMD to kind of catch up to where NVIDIA is, but AMD, you know, is doing their own thing. Like, they're thinking of gaming graphics in other ways because they build the graphics that go in the PlayStation. and that go in the Xbox, and they think of integrated graphics. They're thinking of like graphics that can be put into consumer boxes at reasonable price points that normal people can buy. They're not as interested in, I'm going to make a $2,000 GPU, you know, for crazy gamers. It'll be interesting to see what AMD does, because they talked about they will have their own form of a neural network upscaling similar to DLSS this year, but they're doing some frame generation. Once again, though, NVIDIA has like been here earlier. They're doing multi-frame generation. And let me say, in Cyberpunk, Dragon Age, the Veilguard, which also 250 FPS, everything cranked up, 4K. In Star Wars Outlaws, these games look buttery smooth. Like, I didn't detect any of the artifacts that I used to see in DLSS. Sometimes in DLSS, like, really fringy objects like a metal grate or something far off in the distance would like shimmer a little bit and look a little wrong. That stuff doesn't really appear anymore. They actually have some new DLSS features that are also going to clean up the way their algorithmic upscaling works. It is rendering these games at a lower resolution than 4K, upscaling them, but also doing all these other magic tricks. But I kind of felt like Cypher in The Matrix, right? I know the steak isn't real. I know The Matrix is telling me that it's delicious and juicy, but I'm so tired. I'm so tired of like the low frame rates and the lack of feasibility for 4K gaming. I'm like, ignorance is bliss, I guess, because I can't really tell. My eyeballs can't tell. It feels good. The latency is good. Just feels really good. After all that, though, nobody should buy this card. You should not buy this card, Sam. It is irresponsible. It is immoral. It is NVIDIA just totally flexing. I think the 5080, which is going to be $1,000, hey, that's really expensive, but if you can justify it and if you think it'll last you 5 years, sure,
That seems like more of a sweet spot in terms of like value for performance.
Well, I would say the 5070. If you can really get the 5070 at $550, it does a lot of these tricks. You would actually do some pretty decent 4K gaming for people who have maybe 4K 120 hertz monitors, which are more common. Those have been around for a couple of years. 240 hertz monitors only came out last year, and they're really expensive. I think for most people, like, that card will actually serve you for 5 years really well. Also, because 8K gaming is not a thing. We're not really going too hard beyond 4K. Like, 4K is kind of where we're going to be at for
I do not want to think about 8K gaming in any time.
Don't think about 8K gaming. The only thing people are thinking about is maybe higher refresh rate 4K. And I'm like, hey, we hit 240 hertz. You're doing like decent 4K upscaling. We're good. We are good right here. And I was worried about like what this card would mean for the overall market. And you know what? What is going to be the biggest gaming device of this year, Sam?
The Switch 2, obviously.
The Switch 2.
It's not going to be close either.
It's going to be the Switch 2 by a mile. And even in terms of like PC hardware, I think like the PC handhelds, the gaming PC handhelds, this is a good year for those because those things are getting cheaper. I bought the Retroid Pocket 5 and that thing was like $200, $250. Like, they're getting so cheap. They're really capable. But the Switch 2 is going to be an affordable consumer device that will not deliver these frame rates. It's not going to render in 4K. It's going to look old. Like, a lot of people are assuming it's maybe about as powerful as like a PlayStation 4 Pro, maybe slightly faster than a PlayStation 4, doing good HD, you know, gaming, essentially, maybe just kind of solidifying 60 FPS. But it's going to be an underpowered machine that is meant for mass consumption, that has weird features like a joystick that turns into a mouse. That's what matters, is going to matter more in the gaming world than a $2,000 GPU. This is a pure NVIDIA flex. Nobody buy this card, even though it's like a freaking unicorn. That's kind of where I'm at with this thing. Yeah. So, Ben, any thoughts hearing about this hardware?
I'm thinking that you could really do some serious CAD and SolidWorks work on this.
You could.
That you could definitely like model some protein folding.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like Devinder said, if you're using this in a professional manner,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, it makes a lot more sense. But if you're just, you know, a regular home user playing games on it, it's total overkill.
If you're a video editor, if you are somebody who's dealing with streams, or if you're actually a successful streamer or influencer, then yeah, it may be worth having something like this. But also, a lot of those folks are having other people edit their videos and handle stuff too. So, like, they're not actually buying the hardware they need to support their stuff. It's a whole thing. 5090, good card. Check out my 2,500 word review of this thing. And please don't buy it. If you buy it, please don't, like, just don't tell the world. I also feel like it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to tell people that you bought an RTX 5090 in this economy, in this world that is about to fall apart. I don't think so. So anyway, that's the 5090. If you have thoughts about this thing, or you have questions that you want me to test, like things you want me to test on the 5090, I am in touch with the people from Topaz, the upscaling video software. I want to like do some video upscaling on the 5090 and kind of see what's possible with that thing. So we'll do some of that. Hopefully we'll test the 5070. That's the one I really want to test soon. And yeah, stay tuned for more of our coverage around this stuff. Let's move on to the stuff from Samsung, the Samsung Galaxy S25 event. First off, like, what devices were announced, Sam, and were there any major surprises?
Yeah, so this was kind of like, as far as it goes in terms of, you know, unpacked events, it was kind of a low-key event because we only got three new devices. We got your base S25, your S25 Plus, and the S25 Ultra. Now, depending on how you're counting, there were a couple other teases for some other devices that I think we'll get to later. But, you know, even some of the people in chat were like, they were kind of giving like, you know, big yawn snooze for this event because at least on a hardware level, these are very, very similar to what we got last year. And depending on how you're looking at it, the year before that too, because display basically the same design, very similar, charging speeds, very similar. There's a quirk with kind of the wireless charging. And so at least the hardware changes comes down to two basic upgrades. Now we're getting the Qualcomm Snapdragon 8 Elite chip across the board, and that's globally, so that's really, really nice for, you know, Asia and some parts of Europe where they were getting Exynos chips, unlike America where we always get the Qualcomm stuff. So that's really nice to see. It's going to be available globally. Samsung says that it worked, you know, tighter with Qualcomm to kind of, it's not just an overclocked chip of the regular Snapdragon 8 Elite. They kind of changed some of, like, the ISPs or some of the, you know, individual packets inside the SoC. So it's kind of hard to know for sure how much that affects the overall performance, but that's what they're saying. And then for the Ultra, just the Ultra, there's a new 50 megapixel ultra wide camera. And that's kind of it in terms of new hardware. Performance, Samsung is claiming, depending on if you're looking at the NPU, GPU, or CPU, but about 30 to 40% better performance year over year, and about 18% faster frame rates in Vulkan-based gaming. So that's kind of what you're looking at in terms of like speeds and feeds.
I have to say, looking at the new Ultra, Sam, and that new camera and everything, I hate the way this phone looks. What the?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go off weird on a huge tangent in terms of like,
yeah,
just phone design in general has gotten very samey. Basically, you know, you still get the titanium frame on the Ultra, but the whole idea is just like, you have a very nice metal frame, you have glass in front and back, and then you have however many number of little dark circles for however many number of cameras you have on the back. And, you know, all the iPhone and Google Pixel does it too. They all kind of look the same in terms of like your standard smartphone that's not a foldable or whatever. And it definitely bums me out. Samsung, okay, and so I think probably a good segue to talk about how Samsung did tease a fourth member of the S25 family in the Galaxy S25 Edge. And people were saying this is like the most interesting one of the bunch, and they didn't tell us much about it. It's probably not going to go on sale until sometime later this spring or summer, whatever.
So it was just a teaser image?
It was just a little teaser. Mm-hmm. There's a short clip to go with it, and they didn't tell us any specs, price, or anything about that. But basically, the S25 Edge is basically a super, super thin version of the standard S25. At least that's what it looks like. And there are rumors about an S25 Slim, and basically that's what it looks like the S25 Edge is. But the thing is, Samsung used to make Edge phones long time ago with the Galaxy S6
I remember.
Edge.
We were there.
Yeah, the yes. Galaxy Note Edge, the Galaxy S7 Edge. And they had cool, like, it had a cool, like, glass edge that you could use it to like put apps on and stuff like that, or at least app icons. But this is just a really, really thin phone, and so it's like, okay, fine, I guess, but you could do more. And so some people are saying this is the most interesting one of the bunch, and I'm kind of sitting on the opposite side of that, because do you know why I'm not impressed? Because this is basically one half of a foldable phone, and then they just put a regular screen on top instead of a flexible screen.
And it's so, like, what do you...
Yeah, so the thinness is almost... It looks to be exactly the same thinness as, like, the Galaxy Z Fold, but, you know, cut in half, and then they put a glass screen on top.
So they're probably... They saw those rumors about the ultra-thin iPhone. I feel like Samsung is like, hey, we got to have an ultra-thin phone.
Yep.
And we got to be further faster. But I saw people getting excited, like, ooh, screen on the edge. And I was like... We've been doing this for too long because I remember. I was thinking,
just to be clear, the S25 Edge does not have any of those features. It's just a regular metal frame. And so that's, it's a thin phone. I thought we were over the thinness wars in phones in general, but I guess people are excited about it again.
Remember the Narnia phrase, do not speak the old magic to me, which I was there when it was written. I was there when the old, Samsung, Edge phones were created, which had, they had some features.
They
had, weird touch features. This was a full decade before the foldable phones or anything. Just kind of wild. And that was their one more thing. That was their, after all the announcements, we've got one more surprise for you. Were people actually excited for it, Sam?
I think... Like I said, it's like maybe I'm out of touch because I think the idea of a super thin phone people are excited about again. Maybe younger people are like, I want something.
They didn't know they weren't here for the last Edge phone, so the Samsung
and it's like
new feature.
They see the Galaxy Z Flip. It's like, oh, that's really nice and compact, but I want something a little bit more durable, but still fits in your pocket easy. I guess that's what the S25 Edge is going to be.
I see some software features. I hear a lot more AI features going on too. Anything notable that you want to mention?
Yeah, definitely. So this is kind of, another iteration or kind of revamp of Samsung's Galaxy AI suite of software. So they're kind of introducing this kind of concept called AI agents. And that basically means that, you can use more natural language controls or voice commands to do things just a little bit easier. And also a lot of the existing features have gotten renamed so that they kind of encompass a bunch of different tools all in one kind of umbrella. So for example, Smart Select, which has been around forever on Samsung phones, is now called AI Select. Okay, cool.
Okay.
And you can use it to take screenshots, turn videos into GIFs, summarize stories. And so this is kind of this is your vision sort of looking at the screen and giving you a bunch of options on what to do with it. And so I think that's definitely nice. It definitely makes it easier to use and easier to understand because you're not looking through a giant menu. And the UI has kind of been changed so that, if you do AI Select, it'll kind of put little glowy highlights around different areas of the screen. So
the Siri design.
Yeah.
What are we doing, Samsung? But we just spent the last year saying Apple's shiny Siri border is kind of pretty. And Samsung's like, oh yeah, it is pretty. Yoink.
And so I think
what
Samsung is obviously learning from some of its competitors and figuring out how to make, AI a little bit more approachable. It's good. Not terribly original, though. Same thing for sketch to image.
Stealing is the word I'd say more than learning. Yeah. But yes.
Same thing for sketch to image, which is you use AI to draw and, you tell AI what to draw. Now it's called drawing assist. So a little bit easier to know. And, they added some more features so you can pull up an old photo and add an AI art to it, or you can use a text prompt to add AI art. And, the results are generally a little bit better, a little bit more detailed. Okay, fine. But I'm really just not sure that, this is the reason that's going to cause people to go out and buy a new phone.
Yeah. It's funny. We saw it do sort of a summary of a couple paragraphs of a website. The summary was just as long as those paragraphs on the website. Just read the words. Read.
Totally. And, also, once again, kind of cribbing off some other...
images of Sherlyn being really silly with the phone, too.
So yeah, definitely go watch our video. Part of the... Uh-huh. We were testing out a new circle to search feature, which allows you to kind of hum into the phone and get, Google to figure out, hey, what song am I trying to identify? It also just straight up listen to music like Shazam. And, Sherlyn, she got a little heat for not humming APT by Rosé and Mark Brown super well. And so, hey. and then she did it again and it was fine. But some other, quick rundown of some new AI features. There's a new audio eraser. So obviously not something that is super new. We've seen Google do this. But it uses AI to, analyze, wind noise and speech. So you can do, a live EQ and then, tune the things up on the fly. super easy.
That's a big thing. I love that.
And then the other big kind of new AI features, what Samsung is calling their Now Brief and kind of Now Bar technologies. And this is basically like, it's looking at what you do on your phone. It's looking at your calendar, your appointments, traffic, weather, and stuff like that. And it's trying to suggest, hey, you know, for example, you have a meeting at 9 o'clock, but your alarm is set for 8:30. You might want to bump that up a little bit. And so it's like, okay, this is helpful. And, you know, the Now Bar is kind of an offshoot of that, and it's going to appear on the lock screen and in your notifications. And it'll do stuff like, hey, you want to watch, you like the Detroit Lions or, you know, RIP Lions for this playoffs. But, like, you know, it'll surface the score right inside your lock screen or on your notifications. But you can kind of already been able to do this before with some of Google's, you know, live notifications. So not, it doesn't feel like, you know, a monumental change from what we have already.
It's also funny looking at Samsung's screens, like looking at their design for their UI and everything. This is just an iPhone. Like, this is an iPhone weather.
It's all thing. Converging. This is convergent.
It's a Magic Island
at its
updates.
Finest.
These are Magic Island updates at the top and the bottom. Like, it is convergence. And I know Apple itself also took a lot of influences from what was happening on Android phones, especially around notch stuff. But I guess, like, the thing I've noticed is, like, Apple tends to work harder in developing a design language. And we're still just like copying. We're still just like in a straight up copy what these companies do. Okay, sure. Yeah.
There is one kind of
other thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one kind of like small hidden thing. That's like Samsung also says that you can use like, you know, natural voice language commands to kind of just manage your phone. So you can go in and like, hey, go in the photos, the gallery app, and be like, hey, find me a bunch of photos with voice commands of like of wine, or find me a bunch of photos from Las Vegas or whatever. And you can even like tell it to like, hey, change the resolution of the screen or turn off Bluetooth or stuff like that. Or you can, you know, say like, hey, remind me to watch, you know, an upcoming sports game. And it'll go figure out which game you're talking about and put that calendar notification in the calendar app itself. And so it's like, it's making it a little bit easier to do more complex commands just with your voice. And I think that's just good from a general accessibility and just usability point of view. But like I said before, I'm not sure that you can convince someone to buy, especially for the Ultra, a $1,300 phone just for kind of a revamp of AI features.
Especially a lot of those features seem like they're hitting Google Gemini. They're hitting things in the cloud. So are these coming to older Samsung phones?
Yeah, and the hum to identify a song thing, it's existed within Google for a while now.
Right, and it's been available in Shazam for a while now. So it's like, once again, it's like, because a lot of these features are available elsewhere, it's kind of a hard sell. That said, like, the phone itself is still a great phone. I was using it last night, you know, kind of preparation for the review, and it's just like, I love the screen, the design, you know, a little bit curvier around the edges, very nice. And it's like, but the thing is, it's a really nice screen, it's a really nice phone, but so was the S24 Ultra, and so was the S23 Ultra, and so it's like, that becomes the really difficult, like, kind of mental process or gymnastics you have to figure out. It's like, is it worth upgrading from a year-old phone, especially a year-old S24
Probably
Ultra?
Not.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
From a 23 Ultra, yeah, or 22 Ultra, maybe you got a little more, you know, overhead to kind of capture. But, yeah, it's really tough. And I do want to mention,
I feel like, Sam, like, just real quick, these phones don't exist for, like, for us, I guess, in a way. Like, they're not for the spec chasers or the people who are constantly upgrading. It's for, like, you want the iPhone equivalent, right? Like, you want an average consumer to go into the store. What's the latest Samsung? Cool. Here's a new one. It doesn't really matter if it's that much different than last year's. But, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and so I want to mention two quick things. Some kind of quirky things that Samsung did for the Ultra specifically. So they got rid of Bluetooth low audio on the S Pen itself, and that means you can't do Air Actions anymore. Now Samsung's justification is that no one was using Air Actions. They said like a very tiny fraction, and even when they
were, what are Air Actions?
Air Actions is like you can do gestures with the pen to control your phone.
yes.
And
yes.
So You're laughing, and kind of that kind of hints, yep, at like why Samsung made the move is because no one was doing that. And even when they were, Samsung says the only feature that people were using was using the click function on the feature to trigger the the phone's camera as kind of like a remote shutter thing. But because you can, you know, still hold your hand up in front of the camera like that, or use your watch or your Galaxy Ring if you have one of those to as a remote shutter, they kind of said, hey, we're going to take this off. It's going to make the, you know, S Pen a little bit more durable because there's no Bluetooth radios inside. And so it is a downgrade, but depending on how you use the phone, you might not even notice.
That was like one of those wild – sometimes Samsung takes wild swings to be a little different, and sometimes that works out well for them. Sometimes it's like, we're going to make a big-ass phone screen. It's called the Galaxy Note. You look ridiculous holding it up to your head. Doesn't matter. Actually, people just want big screens, and that banked for them. They'll fail with the Fold, but still like do successive generations and end up like owning a big chunk of that market.
Yeah. And then the other weird quirk is that this phone officially does not support Qi2, or at least full Qi2. Samsung says the Galaxy S25 line is, quote, Qi2 ready. Now that means
What does that mean?
What does it mean?
So, and unfortunately, let me explain it. And it's really annoyingly like niche. So you can still wireless charge at up to 15 watts. That's kind of been around for a long time. But one of the key components of Qi2 is that the S25 doesn't have magnets inside the phone. So all of the attachment points won't work unless you get a case that has magnets in the case. And so
you
that's
one job, Samsung.
I know. And it's like,
Why do we think this is? Is it because Samsung wanted the phone to be like that much lighter?
I have no idea. Samsung has not given us an official statement on it. I think they're doing it to save a buck. I think it's a purely cost-saving measure. And it's really annoying because even as an Android person, MagSafe wireless charging on the iPhone is one of the best things that Apple has done to phones in recent history.
And MagSafe accessories, like just in general, being able to like slap my phone on my like car dashboard,
and then in like
slap
a almost completely
pack on it,
unprecedented move, Apple gave that tech to the Wireless Power Consortium, who built, you know, use those specs and protocols to help inform what Qi2 is. And so Qi2 is basically the exact same thing as MagSafe, but for all the other non-Apple devices.
This is hilarious.
And then Samsung doesn't follow through by making the S25 fully Qi2 ready. And it's like, yes, most people, you know, they're going to put their phone in a case and they might, you know, if they get the right case, they might not ever know the difference. But it's like, why? You're just making it extra complicated because you couldn't follow through all the way. And it's really disappointing.
It's funny that Samsung is out here like, I will clone the iPhone design a little bit. Like, I think the base S24 and S25 look really iPhone-y. They'll steal a lot of the like UI designs. Apple gives you an actual functional tool that can make your hardware better. Nah. No, thank you. What is going on over there?
All of the like MagSafe accessories work with Qi2 devices. So it's like there's already a huge ecosystem of peripherals and accessories that you could use if you had, you know, were fully Qi2 compliant. But now you got to worry about getting the phone and then getting the right case, and then you're going to be okay.
So it's not Qi2 compliant. I think the word is not Qi2 compliant because Samsung are being little jerks.
And I don't like cases. So that means I got to figure out some sort of weird sticker add-on. Or, you know, there's people out there who have like, you know, you can get like sticky adhesive magnets and put them on yourself. And it's just like, it's just a really clunky solution. And I'm just generally not a fan of it.
I can't believe you're still case-free, Sam. You have two kids now. It's like, they're going to destroy those phones.
Phones have gotten a lot more durable. People used to look at a phone wrong and it would just break. Phones nowadays are actually pretty tough. As long as you don't mind some scrapes or scuffs on like, you know, the frame of the device. I'm not telling you to like, you know, throw your phone off a cliff or whatever.
Sam will repay any broken phone that you have.
But like, give it a try. Yeah. Like I drop my phone constantly. I'm not saying like I'm a perfect human. I don't drop my phone. I try not to drop it on cement or concrete, but like
you have a Galaxy Fold, like you main foldable.
Yeah, yeah. And so if you drop it on like a wood floor, you're generally going to be fine.
Wood floors, yeah. The problem is you go outside and it's like concrete. It's asphalt. It's or you're somewhere it's marble. Like places that will just destroy the sort of like protective Gorilla Glass stuff. So I'm shocked, Sam. Like it has been a while since I've like fully shattered a phone, but still, even when I would get a new phone and like not put it in a case or put a screen, a protector on it, just being in my jeans pocket will add little nicks and little scratches to the screen. I'm like, I don't know why this keeps happening.
Yeah, I mean, I
we were beyond this.
I think for me, it's like I've come fully around to the idea that like it's sad, but gadgets are sort of disposable. And it's like no one's talking about like, I'm going to put some sweet patina on my phone, right? Like these are not antiques, right? You're not passing them down to your kids in 10 years.
Well, some people are, though. Like, that's the thing. Well, the thing about having, like, an Apple device, right? I've got some great patina on my old iPads, and it's great for kids. Like, I have
sure.
Sixth-generation iPad from 2018 that's busted, that has a cracked screen. It still streams video real good.
But,
it plays.
But these
Peppa
are not
Pig
family and heirlooms. You're not putting them in your treasure vault and be like, look at these, you know, marvels of yesteryear.
Less an heirloom and more like, hey, I have this device from a couple years ago. And normally, what do? If it's an Android device, most often it's like trashed or it goes to electronic recycling. A lot of other, like, I do appreciate a device that can last 5 years. If you can go longer than 5 years, oh man, then you're in a special pedigree. And we are well past 5 years with that iPad, at least. Yeah.
Speaking of devices that are lasting 5 years plus, my microphone on the iPhone SE 2 came back. I don't know why it did, but I'm very happy that it did.
You can't trust it. You can't trust it.
I can't trust it. I should get another phone. But Sam, let's return to the Qi 2 charging for just 1 second. Does this mean that if you were to put this S25 on top of one of the like MagSafe charging pucks, would it charge at all? Would you need to balance it in order for it to charge?
Yeah, if you put it perfectly on top of wherever the wireless charging coils inside the phone, it would work. But because there's no magnets, if you move the phone at all or move the charging puck at all, it would just slide right off.
It's the
goodness
killer
gracious
problem with wireless charging, and which is that's why it's taken a decade for wireless charging to really take off. Is that you plug in a phone, you know it's plugged. That's it. You put it on a unmagnetized wireless charging puck. Somebody sneezes, and that phone moves half an inch. You're not charging anymore, and you're screwed. So,
I mean, that's the way a lot of charging pads worked. Not too long ago, within the last couple of years, I remember seeing like a bunch of third-party ones that were kind of like, you know, not Ghost in the Shell. What the heck am I talking about? Full Metal Alchemist style, like alchemy symbols or something, and it'll like do a cool like light show when you put your phone down. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. But you are returning to the logic of charging pads rather than the really satisfying like out of MagSafe.
Does this device work? I'm going to unplug this device. This is what I use next to my desk right now. This is one of those Belkin magnetized charging things. And
they're
you put
great
this on, and it's when I'm doing video calls, the phone can kind of follow me. But also, like, you're good. It feels good. Magnets. How do they work? They work really well for wireless charging.
But unfortunately, they're not in the S25 unless you get a case.
What are you doing, Samsung?
And also, one small thing. You know, a lot of times when we get review devices, especially phones, the manufacturer will include a case with the phone because obviously, you know, you don't want to mess up the review device until you get the review out. Makes a lot of sense, right? Samsung included a case with our, you know, S25 Ultra review unit. Doesn't have the magnets inside. So even though Samsung gave us cases, and Samsung says they are going to make some first-party cases along with all the other, you know, third-party manufacturers that have magnets inside. Even Samsung didn't provide a case that would add the full Qi 2 compatibility.
Yeah.
And I feel just, like, so functionally, you can't wireless charge, even with the review units. Cool.
You can, just not magnetically.
Yeah, I can use a regular charging pad, but just not any of the fun Qi 2 magnetic ones.
This is a crack story for you, Sam, or Sherlyn, or somebody. Like, and it really, the only people are like the crazy gadget heads. But what the hell are you thinking, Samsung? Like, the world is fully on magnets for wireless charging. Qi 2 is here. Apple's on it, sharing stuff. That there must be some like deeper, dumber story here. Is it just that Samsung wants to sell their own cases too? Like, they want people to buy phones, but also buy their cases. And cases are a big business, you know, for a lot of companies. So maybe that's part of it.
So we're going to have the full review of the Samsung S25 coming up in the next few weeks. If you have any feelings about the new stuff that Samsung announced in the first Unpacked of 2025, please email us at podcast@engadget.com.
Okay, well, we originally wanted to spend a lot of time talking about, like, the various many things the Trump administration has started doing this week, now that he is, you know, he's back in office, back in the White House. There's a lot of stuff happening, and it's all very, very sad and making me sigh all the time. But real quick, we'll roll through them, and I think we're going to dedicate a future episode to a longer discussion of, like, what is happening with the new Trump administration. But so far, withdrawing from the Paris Accords. Once again, wind energy pause, because remember, he didn't like wind energy. National energy emergency. They're going to refill U.S. strategic petroleum reserves. Really, really wonderful for the fossil fuel industry. I've heard some commentary around that, and everyone's like, what emergency? We are the biggest producer of natural gas and of oil. We're a pretty big producer of oil. Like, yeah, we are doing really well, but, you know. The fossil fuel industry will make more money. Trump is revoking Biden's target for automakers to sell 50% EVs by 2030. Of course, there's also, stopping funding for EV charging stations through the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program. I do wonder if that's going to be a helpful thing for Elon Musk, because Tesla already invested a lot of money they also got from the government to build out its charging network. It doesn't really help them. If there's more charging, right? Because people will just go to Tesla superchargers. Hasn't been announced, but a lot of people are talking about the administration considering killing the EV tax credit stuff, rolling back Biden's AI framework. Anything quickly you want to mention, Ben, just happening here?
How can we possibly build $500 billion worth of data center in Texas in 4 years?
You know,
this
magic.
Like, the scale of this boggles the mind. Like, yeah, eventually you can put in $500 billion worth of computers and their attendant infrastructure with the warehouses and cooling systems and all of that that you would need to do this enormous scale Project Stargate stuff that... It's a project by what? OpenAI and NVIDIA and ARM and Oracle and Microsoft. But I really have to wonder whether or not this is going to end up looking like the Wisconsin Foxconn plant.
It's going to be Foxconn. Everyone's like, he's doing a Foxconn, like within hours of becoming president once again. That is a lot of money that may not actually make it to an AI data center or really anything. So.
Also, it's just such an enormous amount of money that, like, people talk about, like, the amount of money that just passes through the Pentagon and disappears. How much of that money is going to disappear? How many, like, contractors are going to be charging, you know, $900 for each screw they put in?
Money is going to disappear. Like, this is what happened in Russia. This is tends to what happens in, you know, oligarchy.
It happened during the pandemic with the PPP loans.
Happened during the pandemic. Yeah.
Yep.
But you keep your rich friends happy. Seeing everybody, you know, at the inauguration party, seeing Mark Zuckerberg and his wife all dolled up and ready to, like, hang out with the Trump administration. It really does feel like, oh, yeah, the rich are celebrating because they are going to milk this for all it's worth. It is going to be like the PPE thing, you know, kind of all over again. It's
going to be big time government contracts. And, like, really, don't be surprised when you see Palmer Luckey in the news again. He went directly from Oculus to defense contracting.
Well, to a smart border control, like that. That's what it is, because he's funded by Peter Thiel, and it's all like. It's a whole thing. We are going to be talking about all this stuff, folks, because it's all really, really sad. We're barely mentioning the fact that Elon Musk did a full-on Nazi salute twice. And what really makes me sad is that we have not learned anything. Like, as a country, our media organizations haven't learned anything. I saw the New York Times, I saw the Washington Post be like, Elon Musk made a controversial hand gesture.
Right, they're calling it the Roman salute, which I guess is technically accurate, but you know that's not what it is.
I mean, yes, it's historically accurate, but let's also think about how we just mentioned Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel bankrupted Gawker on purpose because he was annoyed that Gawker outed him as a gay man. These guys have so much money. If they wanted to bring petty lawsuits that would lead to more layoffs at the Washington Post or the New York Times or, you know, the Chicago Tribune, if the Chicago Tribune was brave enough to say
that, yes,
like they're afraid of lawsuits.
That's why ABC settled their fight with Trump as well. Like, it's, this is the world we're living in too. Pay attention to facts, people. Pay attention, like, when we see a video feed of something happen, then it's edited, and you know, after the fact, people are saying, "Oh no, that's not really what happened." It's getting really, really Orwellian really quickly over here. But
you really got to shout out Wired for finding a really smart way around this, using the same kind of logic that Andrew Gillum used in his debate with Ron DeSantis. Their headline was, "Neo-Nazis love the Nazi-like salute Elon Musk made at Trump's inauguration." If the neo-Nazis on the internet, if the founder of Gab likes what Elon did, then what does it really matter about the discussion about whether or not it was like an actual Nazi salute? We're going to keep talking about this. This is not going to be something that is just one week of discussion.
This is a big, big red flag, too. Like, we've seen Elon Musk retweet racist and anti-Semitic memes. We've seen him, like, really be buddy-buddy with white supremacists. But this felt like a real big moment. Because, like, with his whole heart, he hit his heart.
And with a small grunt.
Multiple times.
These, like, his online friends and the 4chan people will say, "Oh yeah, he's just trolling." That's the entire point, though. He's trolling to the point where it is just full support of fascism. It doesn't matter if you're joking or not. Like, this is the reality he's building. Anyway, things are pretty dark. That's why we didn't start with this conversation, because it's all kind of scary. But we are definitely going to follow these stories. I want to talk to people, especially working in misinformation and also media manipulation, because I saw several video streams that specifically cut out the Nazi salute, and that was like at NBC, that was at major media organizations, and like that is the stuff most people will see. Most people are not going to see the Wired article or the online conversation, and then this stuff will just be whitewashed, you know, and then it'll be like, "Oh yeah, some progressive activists think he was doing a Nazi thing, but he was just really excited. It was his, you know."
And then it comes around
autism.
To the idea of like, if the video feed that most people saw was not the gesture that he made, then people are going to say, "You know what? That's AI video manipulation."
Also, in the show notes, I don't know, someone dropped a link to a German paper, DZ, and so the headline, you know, translated is, "That was a Hitler salute. It's a Hitler salute.
Nazi
salute. Hitler salute." And it's like, if Germany, people from Germany, who obviously are most familiar with this and are actually, you know, pretty sensitive about how, you know, these things have, you know, happened since World War II, if that's what they're calling it, I'm going to say, hey, maybe they got a point.
Maybe they have. I mean, a lot of people have a point. This is a whole conversation. I will say DZIT did a really interesting thing, too, where they also basically blocked the actual gesture because you can't even show it in Germany.
German has very harsh laws about, you know, portraying Nazi symbolism. For them to like take it as seriously as they are, and then for us to, you know, portions of the US to kind of just blow it off as is like it didn't mean anything, that seems like a really weird disconnect.
What a world we're living in. It's only been, we are in week 3 of 2025, everybody. Week 4 technically, but yeah, I wish we did. I would have loved to live in just precedented times. I would love to live in common, like normal times. But anyway, we're going to be talking about all this and certainly what the Trump administration is going to be doing for the tech industry, for the world at large, for the environment, you know, against the environment, I'd say. But yeah, if you have thoughts, drop us an email, podcast@engadget.com. All right, let's move on to pop culture picks. What do you want to shout out, Sam?
Oh, I've just been watching Sakamoto Days.
I saw that. Yeah.
It's really good. It's the whole premise is that there's a very famous like spy who's just like godlike good at everything spy related. And then he retired to become a, you know, kind of your standard convenience store owner.
He's a family man.
Yeah, he's a family man. He, you know, he got a little chubby, he got a little fat, but he's still like just as like cool and as good as he was before. And I know like some of the, like, you know, the manga diehard people were like kind of clowning on the anime because, you know, the animation quality or the art isn't quite as good as, it's, you know, what they're expecting from, but that always happens. I was like, just go give it a watch for yourself. It's on Netflix, pretty accessible. And I think, you know, if you like a good action anime, you'll probably get sucked in right away.
It's fun. It's funny. Like, it's the thing is, like, I watched, I was excited for because Netflix was promoting this for a while. And I think it's just fine. Like, it's perfectly fine. I wish the animation were better. I also, like, it just really sunk in. They're just remaking Rurouni Kenshin, which itself was sort of like an offshoot of all the, like, revenge assassin, like, movies from the 70s and 80s and everything. Like, there were a ton of movies that did that. Rurouni Kenshin built this whole, like, mythology around a master assassin who became this, like, bumbling, peaceful person. I'm getting a lot of those vibes, but also without the energy, without the fun.
Yeah, Sakamoto, is it definitely more comedic, definitely more lighthearted.
But it's also ultraviolet. It's lighthearted and ultraviolet.
Which I think is kind of a fun kind of dichotomy, but absolutely.
It's very anime in that, like, yes, he can block bullets with chopsticks. You know, it's sort of like you're just going to have to, like, you know, just go with the flow. I'm going to check out more episodes, though. It's not as good as Dan to Dan, which is a complete, like, oof.
Yeah, well, that was easily one of my favorite shows of 2024.
I was actually going to talk about Sakamoto Days as well, so that covers it. But, yeah, check it out. It's on Netflix right now. If you just want, like, something to turn off your brain and, like, forget about the world a little bit, it's perfectly fun at that. Did I shout out Pantheon again? Pantheon's real good. I think I mentioned that last time. But
yeah, you mentioned
Pantheon
it a couple weeks ago.
I finished Pantheon. That is also on Netflix right now. That is fantastic. So if you want, like, a cool thing that is cyberpunky, that has lots of shades of Ghost in the Shell, there are references to Neon Genesis Evangelion in there, but it's an American show that was on AMC and, you know, just wasn't a big hit there. It's on Netflix now. Pantheon, check it out.
Okay, thank you everybody for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Sam online at
Sam Rutherford on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it.
And you can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Blue Sky. I'm on the TikToks at Devendra Talks there, but I also podcast about movies and TV at the Filmcast, at thefilmcast.com.
And you can find me at HeyBellman at BlueSky.social. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, that includes Spotify.
Here's my chat with Jack Greenberg, project manager at YouTube, about YouTube Premium, a whole bunch of new features that launched this week. You can check out the story in Engadget.com. And also, you know, I'm not trying to sell anybody in YouTube Premium here, but I do really like it if you're the sort of person who watches YouTube several times a day. If you use YouTube instead of, you know, broadcast TV or, you know, other streaming services, it is totally worth spending the money to remove ads. That's really the main thing. You can really breeze through YouTube without ads. So they're not sponsoring us or anything here, but I'm just saying I find it super, super useful. Here's my chat with Jack Greenberg. Jack Greenberg, thank you so much for joining us in the Engadget podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your role and kind of what you do at YouTube and over there at Google?
Sure. Yes. So I'm a director of product management, and I lead the YouTube Premium team. So I look after what you get as far as features with the subscription, as well as how you buy it, what plans we offer, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. I think listeners to this podcast and my other shows, like, I kind of bring this up everywhere. I think YouTube Premium is kind of one of those, like, magically great streaming services that I don't think too many people talk about. You know, I think people are used to YouTube as being this free thing that's just like you can go there anytime, watch a few ads, but see whatever you want. But to me, getting rid of those ads and also just kind of like seamlessly plowing through content on YouTube, like, it's been so useful to me. How do you guys think about, you know, convincing people that the premium offering is worth it? Because I don't know if a lot of people think just removing ads is enough, you know?
That's fair. I mean, so YouTube Premium at the end of the day is for people that already love YouTube. And you know, we're so excited that YouTube's a home for so much video content, music content, that sort of thing. And we're proud that ad-supported experience enables that. And so users can connect with their favorite artists and creators. And you've seen recent announcements where we're adding features. Just a few months ago, we were adding collaborative playlists and a sleep timer and all kinds of different things. And so it's always evolving and improving. So for Preem, it's really additive. It's okay, well, for people who really love YouTube, how can we give them even more? And so, of course, it's the ad-free. You can download videos, listen in the background. And today we'll talk about how we're adding some additional features to really make that a deeper experience for people who YouTube is TV to them.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of feel like that. I don't know if it was a gradual transition or what, but my wife and I, like, we just ended up, YouTube is the thing we turn on to, like, hey, we are going to catch up on late night skits or something, or we didn't catch SNL, but YouTube kind of surfaces the good things that you kind of miss. So that's been our gateway to catch up on TV and catch up on that. We've started following creators and smaller channels and stuff too. I am really interested though. Like, I think there are arguments that somehow YouTube may sometimes make the free service worse to push people to premium. How do you guys kind of balance that? Like, how do you balance making the free service actually compelling, actually useful without being too annoying, but also, you know, yeah, making premium something people may want to check out too?
Yeah, we really do think of them as these two different tiers and you really in layers. So, you know, we're always developing the ad-supported service. We are adding features. I wouldn't characterize it the way you know, or in terms of like moving between. It's really like as we're adding, what can we add? And so when my team is designing for the premium tier, we're going through the user feedback. We're looking at what people are asking for. We're also looking at the data in terms of how people are using the product, right? Like and saying, hey, a lot of people, like for instance today in what we're working on, hey, a lot of people are liking downloads.
Yeah,
we haven't had downloads on Shorts, and so let's bring that experience to Shorts. So it's that sort of evolution that is the way we think about it.
I do want to talk about some of those experimental features, the new stuff that you guys are announcing today, specifically high quality audio, which is, again, I am a home theater nerd. I'm a bit of a, you know, I'm a hi-fi nerd at times too. It is really great to see that YouTube Premium is getting 256 kilobit audio. I know you guys have offered that on YouTube Music Premium. Is there a reason like it took so long to bring it over to just the plain video side?
We've been really focused on the YouTube Music app as like where that's your music experience, and that's where you have your radios, your playlists, that sort of thing. And it goes back to that user feedback again. People told us, hey, I love that, and that's really my lean back listening. That's where I go for music a lot of the time. And why can't I have that same audio quality in the main YouTube app as well? And so that's like, you know, it was more of a, when we think music, we think YouTube Music, and I think many users do as well. But it's just kind of like one of those expansions, those like why not kind of things.
Yeah, why not? I mean, especially for things like music videos, I didn't think that this would be a thing I'd be spending a lot of time on YouTube, you know, looking at. But I have two young kids now. My wife and I also like to like go back and look at, you know, nostalgic music videos that we all love, and that is a thing. I guess will people have to re-upload, I guess, videos if their audio hasn't hit 256 kilobits, or like how is the, you know, audio upgrade process going for older videos?
So it obviously does depend on what was uploaded, and so we have to work with what we have. Generally, for this particular like, expansion, if it's been available at that level in the YouTube Music app, we're using the same backend. I haven't heard sort of that request or need, but if you're an artist or creator, really just making sure that you upload in the best quality possible, and we can kind of take it from there.
Gotcha. I feel like indie artists are pretty good with that. I like watching NPR's Tiny Desk concerts too, and I feel like that would be, yeah, that would be, I'm sure they will lean into like getting as much audio quality as they can on those things. You did bring up YouTube, or we were talking a bit about YouTube Music, and I have to say, that is one thing I still can't quite wrap my head around, or like, I guess, how I use it, right? Like, I know YouTube Music has some of the things that are also on YouTube. I'm still not quite sure why I need to be using a whole separate app for that. Also, I'm not quite sure why like, some things that are on YouTube Music aren't on YouTube proper. The whole organization finding things process is kind of confusing. Is that something you guys are thinking about? Have you heard this feedback at all?
So different people like different experiences, yeah. I think is the classic product manager answer. For folks that are saying, hey, I'm in a music mode, you know, whether I'm listening while I work or work out or in the car, YouTube Music gives you that experience, and you don't have to look for the music among the other things. And so people have their favorite music apps that they go to, and so that's where that app comes in. You lifted up just a second ago that sometimes when you're watching TV, you'll want to kind of in the spirit of nostalgia go look at, you know, classic music videos, that kind of thing. That's a different use case, right? And so I think that's actually where we're learning and figuring out how to meet the needs of everyone. Is that for that use case, that you know very well might be something where, hey, the main, you know, everyday YouTube app is just fine. So it's really kind of letting people find what's best for their needs, and it's even for me, I'll use both apps in the same day. I'll fire up the YouTube Music app because I want some music to focus on while I'm working. And then later on, you know, I may be browsing new music videos from that week because I'm more watching. And so it's really we're trying to enable different use cases. And it's funny, you were mentioning before we jumped on that, you know, YouTube is so many things, I think, in the sense of YouTube is also so many different use cases for people in their lives.
I almost wonder, like, I've kind of imagined, like, it'd be super useful if YouTube itself just had, like, a music mode, you know, had, like, a button I could push where there are a whole bunch of channels that just play records and DJs play albums and stuff. It's super cool, but I don't always need to see the video. I'd love, like, a way to shut that, like, I don't know, minimize that or make that less of a thing. Just something I'm kind of thinking about.
But yeah, that's fair, and I think that it's our products are always evolving, so I think we'll keep thinking about that.
I feel like you guys have almost remade Winamp, you know, like, but just on the web. And Winamp started as being like this cool little music app, but then you had videos in there, you had streaming video in there. I remember like forcing Real Player video in there at some point. So it's, yeah, we're just kind of rebuilding the past, I guess, in some ways.
There's some real nostalgia for you.
Yeah, yeah. Just see here. You guys also announced picture-in-picture mode for YouTube Shorts on iOS, smart downloads for Shorts on iOS too. Let's talk a bit about those features, specifically because I'm really wondering how you guys are thinking of YouTube Shorts now in comparison to TikTok. You know, I feel like everyone's in conversation with TikTok or trying to compete against them, or Instagram Reels or whatever. These two features seem useful, but how are you guys thinking of YouTube Shorts just as a service right now?
Yeah, so Shorts have just been amazing for the YouTube ecosystem. They let creators have a whole new way of creating content, right? Vertical short form video, and so that's just enabled all different use cases for when you're not going to be, you know, making a 20-minute video or what have you,
right,
and so, you know, we really see Shorts as a core part of YouTube as a platform, and then as far as these features, it all goes back to like our premium users tell us, hey, I've been downloading videos for the plane. It's so great when I get a text from my friend and I'm multitasking. I can just flip over, keep the video in picture in picture. And those weren't there on Shorts because Shorts is new and you know we hadn't done it yet. And so we are bringing those to Shorts now. And so it's going to be kind of the same idea that premium gives you more features, more capabilities, and we just need to make that a reality on Shorts as well.
I totally get the need for something like picture in picture, but I do know like some TikTok videos, I think the live videos in particular, already just offer picture in picture capabilities. So what is it is weird that this seems like a really core feature that a lot of people could use in on the free version of YouTube. How do you guys think about like what you define as like a premium feature versus something that will go to the free users?
It's an iteration is the short answer, and our team talks about this a lot, year by year. Sometimes when we're developing roadmaps and features, people say, hey, how do we think this might look in a year or two? And so a lot of times it's hey, let's start with what makes sense today. And so what makes sense today is really expanding the existing premium feature set. You know, that may change in a year, and a lot of times it does change as the industry evolves, as what creators are looking for or what creators are creating evolve, and what the use cases evolve. So, you know, this is a expansion of today's premium features, and we'll have to see where it goes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. One thing I have to say about YouTube Shorts, like, it's been fascinating to see how you guys have just jumped into this idea of short form video. I'm not sure if I like the TV experience for YouTube Shorts. Have you guys thought about like how that's presented? Because I guess like when my parents do a lot of YouTube watching as well, I share my premium account, you know, as part of the family plan. And once they get into like a short video, they have no idea what's happening, right? Because the YouTube controls kind of change a little. You can't pause them, right? And then you can't like navigate properly. You can only go up and down, as if you were swiping a phone, but doing it on your TV. I feel like that navigation experience is confusing to them. How have you guys thought about implementing shorts on the TV side, I guess? Changes in mind?
Yeah. It's really been focused on enabling that kind of same use case,
yeah,
which is it's easy, it's quick, that sort of thing. But I think it's feedback like this that is really super helpful to figure out where we need to go next. And I think it's funny you mentioned, because so shorts and long form are kind of two modes of using YouTube, and it's similar to how you're talking about the music. Is there a music mode? Getting these user experiences optimized and making it so that folks can easily switch between them is a continual sort of work in progress, and we're learning as we go to make sure that we move quickly and bring shorts into YouTube, but we'll need to figure out how that mode evolves for sure.
Is it a limitation of the platform? Because I also remember the sort of battle YouTube had to even get 4K on the Apple TV. That was a thing. Like as a home theater fan, like it was weird to see like that whole thing happen. Is it just tough to implement something like shorts on Apple TV or on other platforms? Because I can imagine if it was just like, hey, a quick overlay on top, like atop the YouTube interface, rather than being blackout the screen, right? And you're just watching a video, like a whole separate video. To me, that would be a little faster. You would understand it's not a proper YouTube video. It's just like a quick thing you're taking a look at. Are there difficulties in terms of implementing YouTube Shorts on Apple TV or other platforms like Roku?
So, we're YouTube. In terms of all the different devices and apps, there's of course nuances as we move from platform to platform. I think we were really proud of our TV experience, and I think the usage follows along just in terms of how many people really enjoy YouTube on TV. That being said, when my team is designing our premium experiences on TV, you're often working with a remote with, an up, down, left, and right. And so that brings new challenges, but, it also brings new opportunities that people have this control right in front of them. So, yes and no, it's hard to give kind of a concrete, it changes things. Just like we need to change for swiping on phones and having a trackpad on like a web experience. It's different platforms have different needs.
Gotcha. You guys are also bringing over the conversational AI feature to iOS as well. I actually haven't played much with this. Can you give us a sense of how this works and how do you guys see it being? Like, do you see this being more and more of a thing more people will be using over time on YouTube? Just talking to it, I guess.
Yeah, and so there's two features that we were talking about how we've been working on, and so I'll start with the conversational AI is when you're watching a video, there's a little ask button, and it gives you a place where you can ask questions about the video, you can ask for related videos, and so you can kind of think of it as like a while watching type experience. We know that's a thing, right? People they might be watching a cooking video and want to know what ingredients they need, that sort of thing. We're a lot of it's that we're watching how people are using it and learning about which use cases are really resonating. We're excited that basically we'll be expanding it to iOS. It's been on Android. It's that while watching type experience, which is very different. I would love to talk about our Ask Music as well, where not a while watching. That's like I want something to listen to experience.
Let's talk about Ask Music, because that's also something I have not really played much around with. I have been mainly an iOS user and Apple TV user. So was that an Android feature that's coming over as well?
That's been an Android feature, and that's been in a set of countries that we're expanding now to the UK and Ireland as well. So it's a continued expansion, and this is one where a lot of times, especially in a music context, you're saying, "Hey, I want a certain type of music." And we've had different types of playlists and different recommendations, and of course to try to meet those needs. And this one says, hey, just tell us, right? Like, so, and so the other day I was, you know, I want a cheerful, upbeat, you know, pop mix. And what's really cool about it is it's not just going to give you a generic one. It's going to give one that actually integrates with your recommendations. And so, you know, you can really talk to it kind of like your friend when you're trying to figure out what music to put on. Just say kind of the mood you're looking for, and it will kind of take it from there. Which is
gotcha. Cool. Is there like a new recommendation engine going on there? Like, how does that differ from, you know, just when you search around for something on YouTube?
Yeah, well, we're talking now about like entry points for it and exactly how should it work in search. Right now, it's right in your on your homepage, and so instead of just tapping on one of the playlists or what have you, you tap on it and then you type in or you can use the microphone to basically say just in natural language what you want. So it's a more open-ended way of starting. But yeah, we're actually, I was just talking with the team about search and kind of how it can evolve as part of search too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation right now for the past few years has been really focused on AI and kind of how all the every big tech company is kind of going gung ho on it. I am wondering something like Gemini. I guess the power of having better searching capabilities that could be powered by generative AI, is that something that could eventually help YouTube develop a better algorithm when it comes to searching for videos or finding like a hard to find thing? Sometimes I'm like, I remember a music video, it was about a girl who's wearing some kind of dress or something. Like, there are things that are hard to find sometimes that I know are on YouTube, but sometimes it's just hard to get access to. Is that something Gemini or a future form of AI could be helpful with down the line?
Potentially, right? And I think that's kind of the stage we're at. I mean, broadly across YouTube, we've been focused on the use cases and the viewer needs, the creator needs, and really looking to AI to make YouTube, the viewing experience, more helpful, or to make watching videos more accessible, or to help you know, creators find inspiration, right? And so we've been really focusing on those, and I think the one that you're raising up in terms of finding a video, Ask Music is our, you know, start to that, but there's plenty more to do, and I think just that open-endedness, you know, we've had things like suggestions and sort of moods and that sort of like preset kind of pieces. I think the whole industry has for a long time, but being able to really just say, you know, give me a sentence about the type of mood you're looking for.
Yeah.
I think it's going to create a whole different way of getting started in your music, in your video, et cetera.
Awesome. Anything else you want to add about how things are going YouTube Premium or stuff you're looking forward to personally seeing, you know, implemented over the next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll just lift up that a lot of what we're talking about today is a set of experimental features that mm-hmm. that where we're launching them early. And at first, when we started doing this, we weren't really sure what the sort of reaction was going to be. And I think it all goes back to that. Premium users are excited about the platform. They're excited about their favorite artists and creators, and they're excited about the new features. And so, for the first time, we're making, you know, it so that you can opt into a whole bunch of them at once.
So
instead of having to just pick your favorite one, you know, you can try as many of these as you want that we talked about today. And the big thing is we really do value the feedback, and we want to hear from users in terms of what do they see in Premium, right? Like we're creating a subscription on top of YouTube. We'd love to hear from our users about sort of what they would like to see next.
Gotcha. I will add one to you there. Parental controls, better parental controls. I don't know. Like I just want to block the toy videos. I want to block like there are videos of people just playing with Peppa Pig toys, and it's like, no, I just want my kids to see Peppa Pig. Please, it's in general, like, how is YouTube thinking parental controls and kind of like more kids are watching YouTube, more kids are watching content on tablets and things like that? Is that a big responsibility that YouTube is thinking about at this point?
There's a lot of different use cases to YouTube, and I think making sure that we have a great experience for kids and families is so important. And so we're always kind of working to evolve these different use cases. I don't have anything to kind of specifically to dig into today.
Sure. I do appreciate the lock screen feature. That is has been very helpful on iPads and cars. So appreciate that. Well, Jack, thank you so much for chatting with us. Hope to chat soon. And can you let us know, like, where can people find you online if people want to catch up with you and what you're doing at YouTube?
Great question. Yes, I'm on LinkedIn. People feel free to reach out there.
Yeah, no socials that you wanna share. We'll keep those private. Nobody. Yeah, reach out to Jack. It's okay. Thank you so much for joining us, Jack.
Thank you for having me.